are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. American Bulk, Essays on Excess, by Emily Mester. This book was reviewed by Alexandra Jacobs. We have reached peak feedback. The customer is not only always right, but always writing, rating. The bank, the phone company, and the hospital want us to evaluate our experiences with them on a scale of 1 to 10. There are Yelp reviews of planet Earth. The constant assessment of daily life is among the all-too-familiar but strange developments scrutinized by Emily Mester in her unsettling first book, a collection of personal essays about consumption called, in contrast to its limness, American Bulk. Even at the grave, she notes, buyers are weighing in on the many choices of coffin. One wrote ominously, "I will purchase again." Writing as the alter ego M, folksy or menacing depending on how you squint, Mester herself used to post online reviews of scratchy throw pillows, bad haircuts, a mean history teacher, until a restaurant owner responded to explain the human struggle behind a disappointing burrito. Looking for confirmation of her choices begins to seem, as the young'uns say, sus. In my attempts to reduce the frictions between me and certain objects, Mester writes, I'd multiplied the frictions that invariably remained. If I believed there was a best body wash, I had to fear the worst. Death by synthetic fruit scent? American Bulk is framed by Mester's family dynamic, all roads leading to Storm Lake, Iowa, the longtime home to her paternal grandmother, an English teacher and champion, tightwad, who collected freebies eventually to the point of hoarding and finding the sameness in places including South Carolina and New York City, where the author now lives. Another towering figure in the book is her father, a MAGA Republican and successful lawyer who used to take his five children to Costco instead of church on Sundays. Chain restaurants are soothing, Mester theorizes, because they are the same everywhere, like hymns. Her worship of junk food as a teen landed her in a fat camp, which she described in Live, Laugh, Lose, one of the less original essays, but worth reading for its correctly shuddering assessment that raw tomatoes are enemy number one for picky eaters. Mester and her father, too, accumulate mountains of stuff in different ways. She dithers over her purchases and often agonizingly returns them, seeking joy. He amasses in a spirit of practicality and sometimes just walks away from the piles. The American dream as we know it is abundance, she writes, but is an equally American dream to be able to abandon, drop everything, to jettison without guilt anything that weighs you down. This is not the book to turn to for the true and gruesome ecological consequences of wastefulness, but it excels at restoring texture to the smooth banalities of our consumer existence. Mester is like a Midwestern Baudrillard, distinguishing between the earthy bourgeois glamour of Whole Foods, Target's warm graphic buoyancy, and the hot American urgency of 7-Eleven. She notes how brands have leached the beauty from phrases like Olive Garden, Mountain Dew, and Hidden Valley. Succinctly and painfully, she describes how new efficiencies in the meatpacking business and a farm crisis in the 1980s decimated main streets and small towns. Mester was an indifferent boarding school student who felt alien to the windblown affable prepsters. She wears her lesbianism lightly, and unlike her dad, who left the Ivy League with resentment and credit card debt, returned to Iowa for college and graduate school. Before starting the University of Iowa's MFA program in nonfiction, she got a job as a sales associate at Ulta, the cosmetics emporium where the customer is king, the CEO is divine, and between them, like an isthmus, stretches your cheerful smile. She scrubbed toilets and still marvels at the corporate jargon, A shelf was a gondola. A shelf was an end cap. A shelf was an étagère. An office internship later on involved writing for standardized tests, during which she rarely exceeded a step count of three figures, only putting the phone down reluctantly to defecate, undress, and sleep. That screens can consume the entirety of one's existence is hardly news in 2024, but Mester's confessional, her sustained examination of the shame of shopping more than you need to, has dash and daring. There are underdeveloped stretches, like in the still-bustling malls the book patrols, but American bulk is always alert to the sudden sign that reveals meaning amid all the merch. In this, our review nation, a cultural critic of such promise deserves a big welcome mat. The critic, Alexandra Jacobs, is a critic for the New York Times Book Review and occasional features writer. She reviews all kinds of books, but is often drawn to life writings which include biography, memoir, letters, essays, and some fiction. Rental House by Weike Wang. This book is reviewed by Alexandra Kleeman. Every happy family is unhappy in its own way. Is that the quote? Or maybe it's, every unhappy family is happy to stay that way. Or even, you only learn the ways in which a family is unhappy when they come to stay. With or without Tolstoy's wisdom, most couples know that extended visits from their in-laws reveal new edges to old dynamics between parents and children. Over the course of a friendly visit, tried and true ways of keeping the peace fail to function, and new ways struggle to be born. It's in this strange clash of familiarity and friction that Weike Wang's third novel, Rental House, makes its home. Kiru and Nate are young married professionals living in New York City with high-pressure jobs and a sheepdog. Kiru, a corporate consultant, is the child of strict, highly driven Chinese immigrants who became United States citizens when she was young and instilled in her the belief that to live was to struggle and that to struggle was a given, yet one need not know why. Nate, a biology professor, is the first in his white working-class family to go to college and carries with him a sense of isolation born of climbing into the elite ranks of tenure-track academia. Their marriage is a merging of two cultural backgrounds into a functioning unit oriented around their shared social status. Even their dog's name, Mantu, the Chinese word for a tasty steamed bun, accords with what Nate calls the propensity of yuppie couples to name their expensive dogs after basic starch items. But fork encounters across the novel's two halves expose serious fissures in their relationship that have gone unperceived and therefore unaddressed. In the first half, the couple drive out to a New England cottage they've rented for a month in the summer, where they will host each of their families in succession. First, Kiru's mother and father arrive, armed with mace and carrying coolers full of homemade food, afraid in the year since the onset of the pandemic to eat out or be unmasked around anyone outside their immediate family unit. When Kiru's parents leave, Nate's show up. Cheery Midwesterners whose goals are to see every lighthouse and eat every oyster in the area, while worrying out loud about whether Nate is doing enough to stay in touch with his prodigal brother, Ethan, an aspiring entrepreneur but frequent washout, and whether Nate is assimilating himself too much within the culture and values of his Chinese wife. The book's second half takes place on another vacation several years later. After illness strikes both sets of parents and the progress of Nate's and Kiru's careers means that they're spending more and more time apart. In a lakeside bungalow 2 hours north of the city, where the couple have gone to unwind, a meeting with their neighbors, a well-off Romanian family visiting from Brooklyn, turns sour, and then Ethan shows up to ask Nate to fund an ill-conceived business venture. Wang's elegantly off-kilter structure has a disruptive quality to it, like an uninvited guest. There is a tendency to take two halves of something and assign them equal weight, Wang writes at the novel's exact midpoint, just before the second half begins. Marriage is 50-50, But who sent that? Who believes this to be true? The visitors peel back the layers of the central relationship one by one, exposing resentments and longings that they would rather keep out of view. Kiru is ambivalent about her culture difference. She can't help seeing the world through the immigrant striving she has replicated so well, and yet she also hungers to fit in, to talk schools and real estate with a glamorous young mother she meets on vacation, and to go for a run, ponytail swinging, with Ethan's fit blonde girlfriend. Nate, for his part, wishes mostly to get by without conflict, tolerating his parents' opinions about his life choices, but feeling deeply wounded nevertheless when they fail to see and accept who he is. Through these alienating moments, the pair do not quite grow closer, but they do come to understand that they are alone in their particular experiences of race, class, and culture, together. Wang's two previous novels, Chemistry and Joan is Okay, skillfully draw humor from the foibles and ambiguities of finding your place in the world. In this one, similarly funny, but more focused on the melancholies of place once you've found it, she dramatizes the riddle of adulthood. Even as you flee a family, you carry it along with you, in memories of how and who you learned to be in the past. Of course, couples, if they stay together long enough, become families of their own, fighting against their own particular flaws and disorders. Ease is an illusion, Kiru's mother tells her early in the novel. Nothing worth achieving can or should be easy, and if you chose to do something for its ease, then you have become complacent. For Kiru and Nate, the vacation home is supposed to be a place for relaxation, an escape from the mundane stresses of life. But it presses them up against their problems without the escape of work. The two see each other laid bare, rife with neuroses, disappointments, insecurities, and only then do they see what exactly it is that holds them close. The reviewer, Alexandra Kleeman, is the author, most recently, of the novel Something New Under the Sun. The 10 Best Books of 2024. The staff of the New York Times Book Review choose the year's top fiction and nonfiction. Here they are, the 10 Best Books of 2024. At the Book Review, we spend all year getting ready for this moment. We begin debating our annual best of list in the spring, going to the mat for what we love. By fall, we're preparing for rhetorical slugfests. Ultimately, we aim to pick the books that made lasting impressions, the stories that imprinted in our hearts and psyches, the examining of lives that deepened what we thought we already knew. Book number one, All Fours by Miranda July. July's second novel, which follows a married mother and artist who derails a solo cross-country road trip by checking into a motel close to home and starting an affair with a younger rental car worker, was the year's literary conversation piece dubbed the talk of every group text, at least every group text composed of women over 40, and the first great perimenopausal novel, in just two of many articles that wrestled with its themes. Sexually frank and laced with a novelist's loopy humor, the book ends up posing that most universal question: what would you risk to change your life? Second book, Good Material by Dolly Alderton. In Alderton's brisk, witty novel, a 35-year-old struggling comedian in London tries to make sense of a recent breakup at the same moment when the majority of his friends seem to be pairing off for life. Cue snappy dialogue, awkward first dates, and a memorable quest for a new home. Toss cliched gender roles, the traditional marriage plot, and a ho-hum happily ever after. Not only does Alderton cement herself as a latter-day Nora Ephron, she also puts her own mark on the classic romantic comedy form. There are no second fiddles in Good Material. Every character sings, and there is a deeper message revealed in a surprise twist, having to do with independence, adventure, and charting your own course. Third book, James, by Percival Everett. It takes a lot of ambition, skill, and vision to reinvent one of the most iconic books in American letters, but Everett demonstrates he possesses those virtues in droves in James. The novel is a radical reworking of Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, telling the story not from Huck's perspective, but from the point of view of the enslaved man who accompanies Huck down the Mississippi River, Jim, or, as he clarifies, James. From James' eyes, we see he is no mere sidekick, but rather a thinker and a writer who is code-switching as illiterate and fighting desperately for freedom. Everett's novel is a literary hat trick, a book that highlights the horrors in American history and complicates an American classic, all while also emerging as a work of exquisite originality in its own right. Fourth book, Martyr, by Kaveh Akbar. Cyrus Shams, an Iranian-American aspiring poet and recovering drug addict, wallows in a post-college malaise in a fictional Midwestern town. He's working dead-end jobs and half-heartedly attending AA while grieving his parents' deaths and increasingly fantasizing about his own. Cyrus is lost and sad, but this captivating first novel by an author who is himself a poet is anything but. As Akbar nudges Cyrus closer to uncovering a secret in his family's past, he turns his protagonist's quest for meaning, involving a road trip to New York and a revelatory encounter in the Brooklyn Museum, into an indelible affirmation of life, rife with inventive beauty, vivid characters, and surprising twists of plot. Fifth book, You Dreamed of Empires, by Alvaro Enrique, translated by Natasha Wimmer. History has long been Enrique's playground, and his latest novel takes readers to 16th century Tenochtitlan, or what is now Mexico City. Hernan Cortes and his men have arrived in Moctezuma's palace for a diplomatic, if tense and comically imbalanced, meeting of cultures and empires. In this telling, it's Moctezuma's people who have the upper hand, though the emperor himself is inconveniently prone to hallucinogenic reveries and domestic threats. The carnage here is devilishly brazen, the humor ample and bone dry. The sixth book, Cold Crematorium, by Joseph Debrezeny, translated by Paul Olkvari. Debrezeny, 39, when he was deported from his native Hungary to what he calls the land of Auschwitz, would later memorialize the experience in a book that defies easy classification. First published in 1950, Cold Crematorium is a masterpiece of clinical, mordant observation. In a cattle car, he watches a fellow deportee whose hand retains the gestures of a chain smoker. Newly arrived at Auschwitz, he encounters the lousy barroom piano player he avoided back home. This is more than gallows humor. It's a stubborn fight to stay human and place the unimaginable in the context of the known. Look elsewhere for platitudes. Debrezeny witnessed and reported the best and worst of mankind and showed it to us to use as we will. The seventh book, Everyone Who Is Gone Is Here, by Jonathan Blitzer. Blitzer, a staff writer at The New Yorker, presents a timely analysis of the situation at America's southern border, placing the blame for today's screaming headlines, detainee camps, and unaccompanied minors firmly on post-Cold War U.S. policy. His kaleidoscopic narrative moves between the Central American insurgencies that flooded this country with refugees and the shifting and frequently incoherent policies that worsened the fallout. We meet morally pragmatic domestic politicians, a tireless activist who's moved from El Salvador to Chicago, and Los Angeles teenagers ensnared in gang pipelines. None of it is simple. All of it has a terrible cost. Blitzer handled his vast topic with assurance and grace, never losing sight of the human element behind the global crisis. The Eighth Book. I Heard Her Call My Name by Lucy Sante. When the veteran literary and cultural critic came out as transgender in 2021 at the age of 66, she described in an email to her loved ones the devastating realization that her parallel life, the one presented to her by a gender-swapping app that showed her how she would have looked as a girl and then a woman at various junctures in her life, had passed her by. 50 years were underwater, and I'd never get them back. As she reflects on her upbringing as the only child of isolated immigrants, her early adulthood in 1970s New York, and her career of seeking truths through writing while hiding an important truth about herself, Sante fearlessly documents a transformation, both internal and external, one that is also a kind of homecoming. The Ninth Book, Reagan by Max Boot. This elegant biography of the 40th president stands out for its deep authority and nimble style. Boot, a historian and foreign policy analyst, grew up idolizing Ronald Reagan. But after a decade of interviews and research, he finds himself asking whether his one-time hero paved the way for Donald Trump, the man whose ascent to power led Boot to abandon the right. The book is a landmark work that shows how Reagan emerged from his New Deal roots to become a practiced red-baiter and racist dog whistler before settling into the role of the optimistic, all-American elder statesman. It's no exaggeration, Boot writes, to say that you cannot fully comprehend what happened to America in the 20th century without first understanding what happened to Ronald Reagan. Finally, the 10th book, The Wide, Wide Sea by Hampton Sides. In this masterly history, Sides tracks the 18th century English naval officer James Cook's third and final voyage across the globe, painting a vivid and propulsive portrait that blends generations of scholarship with the first-hand accounts of European seafarers, as well as the oral traditions of indigenous Pacific Islanders. The story begins in Britain as the last embers of the Enlightenment are going out, a time when curiosity and empathy gave way to imperial ambition and moral zeal. Between tales of adventure on the open ocean, complex depictions of Polynesian culture, and colorful scenes of a subarctic frost littered with animal life, Sides expertly probes the causes of Cook's growing anger and violence as the journey wears on and the explorer reckons with the fallout of what he and others had wrought in expanding the map of Europe's power. The name of this band is REM, A Biography, by Peter Ames Carlin. With its jangly guitars and wistful harmonies and perfect-shaped songs, the indispensable rock band REM was magic from the start, a college radio darling in the early 80s before breaking into the mainstream. Carlin's biography chronicles its rise in the music scene of Athens, Georgia, and the evolution of its sound. Dwight Garner's review said the following: that Carlin pays such close attention to how many people had a hand in the band's early success gives his book a spirited communal vibe. Here was a new generation knocking at the door, making music that made you aware of the hairs on the back of your neck. Set My Heart on Fire by Izumi Suzuki. This Tokyo rock novel, first published in Japan in 1983 and here translated by Helen O'Horan, follows a young woman through a world of drugs, music, and highly conditional relationships in which the cool kids are emphatically not all right. Suzuki, who died in 1986, is better known as a science fiction writer for good reason, but Set My Heart on Fire shows her to be a keen observer of the rock and roll milieu. Molly Young, the reviewer, said the following: Suzuki's writing is glamorous, knowing, and effortless. O'Horan deserves praise for the delicate art of transferring coolness from one language to another. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.